Welcome back to Underworlds Underground, the only Warhammer Underworlds podcast where none of the hosts have podiumed at a Grand Clash tournament. Please join us again as we discuss Warhammer Underworlds, our favorite tactical and card and board and miniature game brought to us by Games Workshop. As always, our primary goal with this podcast is going to be to help introduce new players to love the game like we do, and to help players and communities that are already involved with the game to continue to bring new players in or level up their play. My name is Thomas, and joining me today is Mike, or Sleekspole, the author of the Sleekspole blog. How's it going, Mike?
Hey, man, I'm doing good. I'm doing great.
Awesome. Also joining us is Other Mike, the author of the Spent Glory blog. How's it going, Other Mike?
Getting over a little bit of a runny nose, a little bit of a cold, so I sound a little ill. And this is going to be a freestyle. It's going to be a little more iller this time.
Awesome. So we will dive right into, we are going to start most of our episodes with our Helping Hands segment, where we thank members of the community or, you know, other content creators, anyone that helps breathe some life into this game. Mike, do you want to start us out?
There was a gentleman who helped me construct my Storm of Celestis championship deck a while ago, and he was an absolute blast to play against. He's a Vassalite, a heretic priest. Amygdala is what he goes by. And I'll talk a little bit more about the deck that he helped me construct later in the episode, but he was just an awesome opponent, helped me make the deck flow, and I wanted to shout him out and tell him thank you for the work he put in to make me better.
That's awesome. Thanks, Mike. All right, how about you, Other Mike?
Yeah, I've got a couple things to shout out this time. So as we discussed last episode, and as most everybody should know by now, the Death Gorge season is coming. And with that, there will be two new warbands and two new Universal Rivals decks. And we're seeing some things rotate out. And that's, you know, a lot of changes to the card pool, but it also means a lot of changes to the online resources we use to build decks. So I'd first like to shout out, and I have no idea how this is supposed to be pronounced, but FXDXPZ. Fixed Expiz. They run the Wonderworlds deck building site, which is one of my favorites. And then there's also the MCrat guy who runs Underworlds DB. Those two things are absolutely, you know, necessary for us to function as an online community. When you say, hey, can someone take a look at my deck build, instead of you having to name every card or take a photograph of the card spread out on your table, you can put a link to one of these saved decks, make edits there. People can know exactly what cards are on the thing as they update wording for cards. These things need to get updated. So an FAQ drops, a new thing drops, these guys go in and they spend a lot of their own personal time with no compensation putting together these very extensive databases for us to use. And I'm just, you know, really grateful to them for doing that, because it's a very unsung hero kind of job. And then I also wanted to give a shout out to Beard Arm from the Discords, or David in real life. He listened to our last episode, and in that he heard me say that the Seattle meta is run by Canadians who come down and steal our glass. And he said, I'm not allowed to complain about that unless I come back up north and try and steal some in return. And so I've been duly called out and well appreciative played. Of A, the listen, and B, you know, yeah, he's right. I can't complain about that, because I have never tried to reclaim any. They are having a tournament soon that I, of course, am working during, so I can't fix it, but I'm trying to get somebody to go back and fight for my honor, because I'm a little ashamed, David. You saw right through me.
Well played, David. Well played.
I would also like to thank my wife, Sylvia, who did a ton of work to help edit and publish our first couple episodes. She doesn't care at all about this game, but she does care quite a bit about encouraging our little passion project, and so I appreciate that quite a lot. And with that, we'll move to our main segment, our Making a Statement, where we will discuss a little more about ourselves in the context of actually playing the game. We're going to discuss how we've grown into our playstyles, what warbands and decks we've played through the years, and some of them that have stuck with us. Mike, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, I'd love to. And part of this brainchild came from Anders gave us some feedback. He listened and gave us some feedback and said, hey, I'd like to know a little bit more about like what you guys play and what you've enjoyed over time. And so we thought, hey, you know what? That's a pretty good idea. And then I said, yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. And Thomas was like, yeah, not on this one. But then we did it anyway. You see how that worked? That's awesome. So I'll go through a couple of the warbands that I've enjoyed and the style of play that I like. I started with the beginner's box, the 2021 starter set with Storm of Celestis and Dreeper's Wraith Creepers, and immediately was attracted to the Storm of Celestis, and so started playing them, and just really enjoyed the hold objective play. Now, I started obviously during Harrowdeep, so the hold objective play was a challenge. And using the starter box, you know, the objectives start face up, and so it made it really fun. And I really enjoyed playing Storm of Celestis, but then quickly learned that it's more difficult to play Storm of Celestis with all the objectives flipped over. That was much more of a challenge. And so thought, I wonder if I can crack this. I wonder if I can figure this out. And so I took them and started constructing a championship deck. And the person who helped me with that was the person I shouted out earlier, Heretic Priest Amygdala, and he helped me create a deck that flowed. And I created an article based on that championship deck for the blog. So that's kind of where I started. I really enjoy Hold Objective. I also play Starblood Stalkers. And then I sort of started drifting into a lot of the Stormcast. I played Xandar at Xandar's True Seekers, did a whole three-part blog post on them. And I still think they have play. I really push them. The one time I played them where they just did not cut the mustard is when I played against a Phylum Seismic Shock when that was really new in a tournament. And I was going to need hot dice, and I did not get them.
I feel like you're not going to cut the mustard with a lot of people in that situation.
Yeah, maybe that's true. So that was a resounding loss. And shout out, by the way, to one of our guys in our meta. His name is Hunter, and he's the one that rocked him. And he placed first, and he placed first with authority. So that was a really fun to see him excel in that and get those Xandar's True Seekers out of the board. But I really enjoy Xandar's because they do have a little bit of that effect where if you lose a fighter, you're inspiring fighters, and so it's not all bad. And I'll tell you what, Xandar or Doraz inspired, even Luxa inspired, is just awesome. They are just awesome fighters. And so they were a lot of fun. So Xandar's, I really pushed them as far as I could with Tooth and Claw. And then as part of that experience, I fell in love with Tooth and Claw because I'd always been playing Storm of Celestis or Starblood Stalkers, and they were always holding objectives. But what I discovered with Xandar's is I really like Tooth and Claw. And look, I know it's a bit of a simpleton's deck, right? It's like plus dice, plus damage, plus move, good luck, you know? But I like that play style. It's just fun to me. And it's live by the dice, die by the dice. And I don't mind that. I actually really enjoy it. So I sort of fell in love with Tooth and Claw at that moment. And then I adapted Tooth and Claw into Iron Souls. And the reason why I chose Iron Souls is I wanted sort of an anti-Aphilum build. And I know at first glance, you would probably look at them and say, how is Iron Souls good at challenging Aphilum? And what I did was I loaded the deck with pushes and extra moves. And so they're just way faster and they still hit just as hard than most people are expecting. So in fact, Thomas, we did a Vassal game like that with Iron Souls, and we never quite completed it, but that was why I got into the Iron Souls. And then I played lots of Hexbane. I won my first tournament with Hexbane, and they're great. They're super fun. But that's a little bit about what I've been doing. Now, top secret project that I'm about to spoil. It's okay that I spoil this, right, guys?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we talked about it. We're going to...
Cool.
This will be spoiled today.
It's all cool. All right. So the three of us decided that we were going to do a project with the Aranai. And so I have been playing lots of games with them. And again, adopting Tooth and Claw, and built a Nemesis deck with them that I think is pretty good. And I'm going to take them to a tournament and we're going to see how they go. Oh, I just realized if this episode comes out before the tournament, I've just completely spoiled what I'm... That's okay. Whatever. No one's going to listen to this.
I mean, just kidding. They're gonna hear this warband that nobody knows about and nobody sees coming. You look it up all you want, man. We're the only ones doing this.
We also get to decide when this episode comes out.
Yeah, that's fair. So anyway, so that's the project we're working on. And every one of us is going to take a different Nemesis pairing. And we're going to get some play in with them. And then at the very end, And we're going to be publishing articles on Sleekspool. So you can read about the different Nemesis decks, about our experience with the decks. And then we're going to play a round robin between the three of us and report on a podcast about how that went. So I think it's going to be a fun project, but that's what I've been dipping into.
All right. With that, we'll jump straight from there into talking about Other Mike's trajectory, and then I think we'll wrap back around to we have some interesting like crossover in our play styles. But Other Mike, what do you have for us?
Yeah, so we'll start by saying today, if you had to classify me as a player, I am more of a flex, hold objective, kind of counterpunch player. I mean, most of the time, if you put me in a dream matchup, I'm staying in my territory and you have to come to me and maybe we'll fight in the midboard. But it did not begin that way. So as I talked about before, when I got the first box, I chose Garrix Reavers because I thought their poses were more dynamic and more people were playing the Steel Arch Champions, and I didn't want to do the same thing everyone else was doing. So I took the obviously inferior Warband and then had obviously inferior results. And part of it was because I was not using good cards, didn't know how to play, didn't know what I was doing. Part of it is because they just aren't great at that. And so I learned the best way to succeed with them is not actually to do four charges, because you're just going to send a one dodge, two wound fighter to his predictable fate. So what I did instead is say, okay, well, I'm going to play some hold objective cards and I'm going to hold objective two on hopefully my side or in the middle. And then if you have to come to me to get me off of it, now I can get supports on my attacks and be a little more successful. So that's kind of how I learned to do that. And then I forgot all of it promptly when Iron Skulls Boys came out. And I thought, okay, these sculpts are great. I really like this idea. I'm gonna charge forward and I'm going to just crack some skulls. And so that's what I did with those guys for a long time. I played Iron Skulls Boys 20, 30 times, which for me at that time, not playing as many games, was a significant part of a year and a half probably that I was using them well into Night Vault when they were no longer worth using. But that they were a lot of fun for me in my first real love with this Warband can take a hit and survive, and they can do some damage, especially when they're inspired. And everyone's going to get inspired because it's hard to take a guy down in one shot when they have five wounds. And then when the Eyes of the Nine came out, I switched over to them. So the Night Vault box came out. They introduced Magic. I said, I don't know how I feel about this. But Magic became the thing to do. And so Eyes of the Nine were who I picked up next. And then I had to fall back on that kind of counterpunch thing again because they don't have the capacity to really run in. You can maybe drop the Blue Horror behind somebody's lines and mess their day up that way, but you're not going to do a lot of damage. You're not going to really do anything other than make them split their attention. So sitting Vortimus in the middle or in the back and then having Kacharik take out anybody who comes too close to him while he casts spells for scores was something that I did for a while. And again, they're not the greatest Warband in the world, but that was the way that I played for the end of Night Vault for the most part. And then Beastgrave dropped, and I didn't really discuss it last time, but in Warhammer Fantasy, the Beastmen were the army that I had and the group that inspired me the most and had me really get invested in Warhammer in the first place. And so when I saw they were making a Beastmen Warband, I said, I'm going to play them. I don't care if they're good. I don't care if they're bad. I don't care how they play. That's going to be my team now. And that was my team for a long time. Grashrax Despoilers are, again, not the greatest, but if you want to succeed with them, at that time, it was kind of a flex hold defensive thing. And so that was how I learned to play. And I leaned on those previous lessons where I say, okay, they have a Surge Supremacy. I'm going to put Supremacy in. Eventually, they came out with the Dug In card where the same three objectives have been held twice in a row. And so I was just saying, how can I hold on to these and eat you alive when you come into my territory? And that was what I did with them for a long time. But it wasn't really working very well because eventually Grimwatch became a problem in my area. There are a couple of guys who are very good with them. And if you don't put fighters over the line, then they inspire and then they become a real issue. And so I switched over to Rippa Snarlfangs just to get fighters over and start chewing up some zombies. And that was a lot of fun. Aggro is fun. Mike is right. If you just roll dice, you're actually going to enjoy yourself. And that's part of why I've never actually leaned all the way into full hold objective. Because, there are builds you can do with various warbands where you're only just trying to get on tokens, stay on tokens, and you make a couple attacks to drive people away, but it's not a main part of your game plan. You don't have cards that are kill surges or anything like that. And I have always wanted to roll dice when I play the game, even if that maybe is not the most efficient or optimized way to play. But it's fun. That's why I play a dice game, is to throw some dice. And Dire Chasm. I started playing with Dread Paget because they had a lot of cards that said hold two or hold more than your opponent. And again, I could just kind of hang out in the middle and say, why don't we come fight and scrap here? And I don't want to send one fighter in at a time and have them die on your swords while I just watch. But again, that didn't work very well because especially early in the season, Dread Paget was not super strong. So I just changed to Kagura, which again was a big mistake. And then I did the Cunning Crew when a Herodeep came out and I played them for a while with the same kind of story. I'm going to hold stuff in the middle or on my side and you have to come to me and then I'm going to have all this support stuff to pile on you. So again, it's kind of the same theme. That's how I've played for the whole time. And I think the warband that really currently is my favorite and has been for since they came out is the Sons of Elmorn. Again, they're not the world's greatest warband, but if you play them as a flex hold defensive, they do okay. And the Fearsome Fortress Rivals deck is, I think, one of their best. And in that vein, Fearsome Fortress is hold some stuff in the middle and let them come to you and then kill them when they do. And I have used Fearsome Fortress with almost everybody that I've played since. That just makes sense to me. It's a warband agnostic deck, really, to me. Like, there are some that do poorly with it, sure, but you can take Fearsome Fortress with almost anybody and play the way that I normally play and do just fine. So that leads us to our current project that we're all working on. So it has been spoiled. We are all taking Grisel's R&I and trying to make things work. So while Mike is taking Tooth and Claw because that's what he's naturally good at, I am taking them with the Toxic Terrors instead, which is not something that I'm naturally good at. I do have to be some invading aggro kind of stuff. But it does have cool positional tools. It does have some cool control aspects where you poison somebody. I've been through a couple iterations of the deck playing guys in my local scene, and I actually started out doing quite well, and then I've lost several times in a row since because it ends up I can't take down large fighters very reliably with two wound fighters or all the pings that come at me. But I'm working on it. I'm figuring it out, and I think there actually is a way to succeed with them. So It was a challenge we decided to present to ourselves because we all like them thematically. We think they're cool looking models. We think they're a cool story. You charge and you roll dice. And you get rewarded for making lots of attacks. And yeah, are you dice dependent? Sure. And do they lose more often than they win according to the greater community? Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they can't succeed. And so we're trying to figure out how do we make R&I as good as they can be. You know, maybe not winning a Grand Clash, but doing all right. And we I think have the capacity to do that. We've done okay so far in our local scene. So Toxic Terrors R&I is what I'm working on right now. And it is a bit of a change of pace for me because I have to put my leader in danger and see if she can take a punch and hit back. And sometimes the answer is yes. And it's actually a lot of fun. So that's what I've been up to recently. And I'll hand it back over.
I was going to say, your list of warbands is like, what's the opposite of All-Stars?
I think they're called the JV squad.
I mean, I'm looking at your list here. Garrix Reavers, Iron Skulls Boys, Eyes of the Nine, Grashrax. I mean, Sons of Elmorn is better than any of those, but Sons of Elmorn was the whipping boy of the Gnarl Spirit pack when that was released. I mean, man, you know how to choose them, man.
I mean, the Cunning Crew is pretty good.
The Cunning Crew is good. Cunning Crew.
I think that's probably the best warband. And Rippo is the other one that was
Rippo's amazing. Good.
But I didn't play either of them for super long, in part because, like, and this isn't, to toot my own horn or anything, but I want a challenge. I want to feel like
it's
a close game. And if you win a couple of them in a row by 10, 20 glory, you're like, well, maybe, this wasn't that fun for me or my opponent. And so I'll try something that's a little more tight.
Well, and look who's commenting on your warband selection, the guy that played Storm of Celestis as competitively.
Yeah, so who's JV now, man? Like Iron Souls, Condemners? Like, I don't even know. Who are they? Who are these guys?
Iron Souls is good.
I actually agree with Iron Souls being kind of secret hidden tech, but I'm also not very good at this game. So, but I will talk about where I'm at in this game. I also just really like anything that wears heavy armor. I love Stormcast. When I started playing AOS, like basically right when it dropped, I got the Stormcast half of the original starter. And so, of course, I got Steelhearts out of the original Shadespire box. Played them a ton. They are kind of the, like you said, the more forgiving half of that starter box, right? So although I only have three fighters, they don't die if you look at them wrong like Reavers do. So I mean, I wasn't playing very seriously. I didn't play to any amount of competitive level early on, but I played them basically right up till Night Vault, and then in the Night Vault core set there were Stormcast Wizards, which are my two favorite things in this game. I love Stormcast and I love Magic. My AOS army is centered around all of the various wizard types. And I know Stormsires was, you know, a problem competitively, but again, I wasn't playing competitively. And I have been and always will be an aggro player at heart. So I never played the like Turtle Stormsire deck. I always played Inspire Amnis, run her forward and punch stuff. And then she probably dies and I probably lose. But so basically throughout Night Vault, I played Stormsires in a overly aggressive manner. The game was never super healthy in my area, but definitely died shortly thereafter going into the Gur seasons, Diachasm and Beastgrave. And then, of course, somewhere in there, the pandemic happened, and so the game never really had a chance to come back until when the Harrowdeep box came out. It again had a Stormcast Warband in it, and so I picked up Xandires, and I played them a decent amount, started getting people to play with me, and so I got a ton of practice with them and against them, because they're pretty easy to hand to a new player and be like, here's the very just clear thing they do. Plus, they're like pseudo aggro, so I got a lot of, you know, fun with a little bit of invade and a little bit of punching. I've played my fair share of basically all of the Stormcast Warbands. From there, around that time, I, you know, was getting back into the game. So I started kind of going backwards and collecting things that I had missed from the Gur seasons. So I played quite a bit of Mad Mob, and I played quite a bit of Crimson Court. Started learning more about the game via like podcasts and blogs and stuff like that. So I, you know, was building decks that were actually cohesive and learned less just flat out aggressive playstyles. And Crimson Court and Mad Mob were the two that I like focused on to do that with. Then, of course, the Nethermaze box came out, and my absolutely favorite warband was in that box. I fell so much in love with the Shadeborn, and they are probably still the warband I have the most reps on, just because I love their theme. Their playstyle is really fun. I call them Elf Aggro, or I reference them as being Johnny Aggro, using the Johnny personality type from like Magic the Gathering or other competitive card games, but being like combo aggro, where like they're, at the end of the day, they have elf stat lines, right? They are squishy, but they're still aggressive. So somehow you have to balance that. And so it does kind of like force you to play a counterpunch or like this push and dance kind of playstyle. And I still really love that to this day. I still bust them out and play them all the time. I think that their objective deck specifically can be a little disappointing at times. Building with it is really hard. It asks you to do things that they are not built to do, but I still love playing them, and they let me do some fun weird aggro. I played them basically up until Gnarlwood came out. I am, like I said, aggro to my core in this game, and so I played a ton of Gnarl Spirit Pack. You know, they are strong. They were very strong, of course, when they came out. So I did kind of, you know, like other Mike mentioned, kind of shelve them just because I'm a lot of times playing against people newer than me, and that was a very, very strong warband, so I really only busted them out on occasion, continued to play Shadeborn more than anything, and at that point, with Nemesis and being able to pair them with Delvers, Shadeborn kind of felt like they found a little bit of a groove that wasn't just like, let my elves die. From there, the Arenai came out. Again, aggro elves. I'm super stoked for both of those things, and you know, we've already talked about our special project. I picked the deck that is actually the most like antithetical, I think, to my personal playstyle. I know, Other Mike, you mentioned that that's true for you too, but I picked to pair them with Fearsome Fortress, which I think is not only antithetical to my playstyle, but it is also kind of in opposition to what the Arenai want to do. They are inherently aggro, and so pairing them with the hold in the middle of the board deck, you know, on paper looks a little wacky. What do you guys think?
Yeah, when we talked about this originally, you know, I said, okay, obviously Tooth and Claw is a great fit for them. And we know, you know, Mike is the Tooth and Claw guy, so he should do that. And then what should we do? Because none of the other decks really seem to fit. And I said, I played the Toxic Terrors with them a couple times, and it felt okay to me, but I don't want to take that if there's nothing else for you to do. And you said, oh no, I've actually already got a Fearsome Fortress deck cooked up, and I just thought, did I read that wrong? Like, how could you have picked that out of all the options? Pick the yes, I'm going to stand in the middle and dare you to come hit my, you know, acrobatic elves and try and stand on an objective. But, you know, you've won a couple games with them by pretty solid margins. So, you know, obviously you found the secret sauce. Or maybe it's just that flex hold is the best way to play and now you're finally learned.
And the arena just really aren't bad. You know, they're squishy, but they're not bad. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. You know, I think it's hilarious that we decided to launch a project with four of the five members of this warband being on two wounds in the right. greatest ping meta that has ever existed
right.
in Underworlds. I am very curious to see how this project goes. And, you know, stay tuned, everyone who's listening, because this could go down in flames and go down fast.
At the end of the day, they're fun to play. Even if this project, our final conclusion is that they will never be competitive, which I don't know. I don't think that's going to be the case. But even if it were, they're a lot of fun to play. And I really do like pairing them with weird decks to see. Because none of the decks fit perfectly with them, all of the decks feel like, well, I don't know, I'll find something in here that works. And, you know, I find often I personally Voltron Grizzale a lot. Voltron in this context means that she gets the majority of my upgrades, and so a lot of little pieces come together to make her much more powerful than her card just is anyway. And I find that she becomes kind of bulletproof. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, that's definitely true. The other thing I was going to say is, I mean, you guys are saying that Tooth and Claw pairs pretty well with them. I would agree. But even in Tooth and Claw, there's issues. Because
yes, absolutely.
There is a variety of upgrades and things that you would put on them that would either reduce their defense, which you never want to do with these guys, or they increase their range one attack actions only, and they have a ton of range two, including their upgrades. So I was immediately put into a dilemma. I'll outline all this in the article on the decisions I made and why.
Sure. But
there are dilemmas in Tooth and Claw, and you have to be ready for those. It's not a perfect fit, but it's a good fit.
You mentioned that you never want to reduce their defense characteristic. I am quite tempted to play them with Voidcurse Thralls, and I think that maybe in a follow-up to this project, we may talk about other decks in Nemesis rotation that can or will be played with them. And I think Voidcurse Thralls could be in there, and I guess we'll find out in the continuation of this Arenae project. But from the Arenae, for me, in my trajectory, then the Weird Hollow box came out, and guess what? Again, it had Wizard Stormcast in it. So, of course, I was immediately in love and absolutely had to pick them up. The Storm Coven are, I'm not going to say my favorite warband, because I said the Shadeborn were, but if I could pick two, these are probably my favorite warbands from all time, with Stormsires just coming in a, you know, in a close third. I, again, just immediately built a bunch of aggro decks for them and had a ton of fun just like running around with these crazy aggro wizards. I still think the aggro decks that I have for them are very fun, but because, you know, we've been talking a lot about playing at a semi-competitive level, we're all going to LVO, so I've already started doing like tournament prep. I did break down and build a Seismic Shock Hold 2 deck for them, and it is all about staying very safe in my territory and just shooting anything to death that tries to encroach upon that. So this is more or less my first like dive into a, you know, more hold style deck, because I have always found that to be incredibly boring. But now I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's performing pretty well for me, and I'm really enjoying getting to play even the like various decks I have built for the Storm Coven, to play the same warband in a bunch of different ways. I feel like they have a bunch of push and pull and like flex and responsiveness that you can have in them. There's a ton of utility in their deck. Just their stats give you just a ton of options. They all have a range 2, just really hard hitting attack, and they all have a range 3 fairly reliable spell attack that just does slightly less damage. So I am loving playing them in any shape or form that I can, and I am excited to see, you know, every new deck that comes out, I'm excited to see if I can make it work for them. Of course, Force of Frost is on the very near horizon, and people think that it is going to be the deck to pair with them. You know, I haven't played with it yet, but I've been looking at building some stuff on Underworlds DB, and I'm not convinced that it'll perform more consistently than my Seismic Shock deck does, but it will give me, you know, just one more flavor of variation to play with them. And I, of course, am excited about that regardless of how competitive it ends up being. But I think that's more or less going to close out our making a statement. Do you guys have any final comments about our trajectories through this game?
Yeah, so you said that you love anything with heavy armor, and then you said your favorite was the Shadeborn. So just want you to reconcile those things for yourself.
That's true, that's true. When I started playing this game, I was like, I'm always just going to play the Stormcasts. And I did not realize, I guess, at the time that there is a deep love for elves somewhere in there. And I guess really just the, like, mean ones, the murderous elves, because I really only play Shadeborn and Arenai. I don't play much of the other elves. So yeah, maybe that says a lot about me.
Yeah, our next episode will be psychoanalyzing your choices in warbands to see what we come up with. You guys will learn more about Thomas, and he'll learn a ton about himself.
Great. I'm definitely looking forward to that. All right, so I think we're ready to move on to, I think every episode we're going to do an Uncovered Secrets. As long as I can keep coming up with ways to keep you on your guys' toes, we're going to keep doing it. So this episode's Uncovered Secrets is actually going to be kind of a farewell to a card that I have thoroughly enjoyed, and especially lately, especially in our Arenai project. So out of the Fearsome Fortress deck, I want to analyze the Tanglebriar card. Tanglebriar says, place one available snare token in a hex within one hex of one or more friendly fighters. I know this card is not very good, and I've been told a lot of times that I should not be playing this card. I love this card, and Mike, I've seen you play it before too, so I'm very interested to see if I can get you guys on opposite sides of this one. We'll see. But for me at a glance, Tanglebriar, you would assume you're trying to throw a snare under your opponent or in a defensive way, so you put it out in front of yourself to kind of make an inopportune charge lane, but I have found that I use Tanglebriar to put a snare token under my own fighters like 9 times out of 10. It sets up a cheeky bold sortie, which says score immediately after an activation step in which a friendly fighter's charge action began on a feature token in your territory. You can just throw the snare hex under them and then immediately charge off of it, and there was never a chance to like push you off. I mean, other than in the power step, of course, but there was no activation in between for your opponent to kill that fighter or push them off. Similarly, in the last power step of the round, I have absolutely scored an extra cheeky point for Conquered Domain, which says score this in an end phase if there is a friendly fighter on a feature token within one hex of no one's territory, and gain one additional glory point for each other friendly fighter on a feature token within one hex of no one's territory. So there are obviously, Fearsome Fortress focuses a lot on feature hex tokens within one hex of no one's territory. And so frequently I have been able to use Tanglebriar to just at the last moment meet one of those conditions. What do you guys think? Let's start with Mike. Can I get you talking about, I know you've run this card before.
Yeah. So I have run this card before and I like this card. Do I believe that this is the most efficient use of a Gambit slot in my deck? I'm going to say maybe. Okay, I would say it's circumstantial for all the reasons you mentioned. But keep in mind, there are other cards that this can score off of. For example, Underground Fortress in the Fearsome Fortress deck. So score this in end phase if three or more friendly fighters are on feature tokens and two or more of those fighters are adjacent.
Absolutely.
Right? So this, if you just bring your fighter adjacent, boom, you put a feature token on them, you're good to go. Right. So I like that a lot. I do, like you mentioned, this is an extra glory in Conquered Domain if you play your card correctly on this. And so I do think that because of the way it pairs with the objectives, and then you mentioned Bold Sortie, because of the way it pairs with the objectives, this is potentially a glory generator. And
right.
Even though Gambits, you know, you can put Gambits in your deck that enable you to destroy other fighters or reposition to gain supports and things like that, I have always believed that the purpose of my power deck is to help me score my objectives. Right. And so in that, for that reason, I think it's a great card. If you align yourself with that purpose, I think it's a great Gambit card to have in your deck.
Awesome. All right, Other Mike, what do you got?
So you've succeeded. You've gotten us to take opposite sides. I don't think Tanglebriar is a great card. And we're not even going to touch on the fact that now that there isn't going to be a stagger, snare, side.
We will in a moment, card is, for sure.
This card is possibly not even valid in the next couple weeks. Let's take it as it has been for the last little while. I play a lot of Fearsome Fortress. I've played it with, you know, a good 8, 9, 10 warbands. I've never found it to be useful, and I don't include it in any of my competitive decks. And so I'll say, here's the positives, right? You can place it under one of your own fighters to score a bold sortie if you have it at the right time. You can up your conquered domain. You can possibly make a proud Castellan. You can possibly do raw materials. You could possibly do raise the walls. You can possibly do, you know, the kind of things like underground fortress. But these are all possiblys, right? And if you have stacked your deck full of, okay, I need 3 tokens adjacent. I need however many feature tokens in this thing. I need raw materials to place a feature token. You're depending on a card that allows you to place an available token. You've already placed one of the 2 tokens when you set up with Fearsome Fortress. But if you're playing against another Fearsome Fortress, they've placed a token. If you're playing against Daring Delvers, they're placing tokens. Now, if you're going to be playing against Force of Frost, they're going to be placing tokens. You're going to be running into a situation where there may not be an available token to place. And I would hate to draw raw materials or hate to draw Underground Fortress and be sitting there saying, I don't have the capacity to put this into effect because I don't have the gambit that I need at this time. And so I actually looked at it more value as not like putting it under myself, but placing it in a way that added stagger to my opponents. Because there are several other stagger cards in the deck. I mean, defensive charges, you can do staggering somebody with the Star Mott. You can stagger people with a couple of different effects. And then that does allow you to use Opportunistic Reprisal, which is a great card if you have it at the right time. And I just never found it to be worth its weight. I mean, you only have 10 gambits, and I prefer ones that I know I'm going to be able to use at every phase of the game. If I'm already standing on feature tokens with my 3 surviving fighters, I don't need to put a token under them because I already am on them or something has gone really wrong. And so, like, if you draw this in, you know, round 1, you drop it under somebody and then you charge off of it, you get Bold Sortie. That's your Christmas fantasy land we talked about last time. But if you don't draw the card at the right time, it's just not useful. Like, I don't think I need it in round 3, you know? And I prefer to keep my gambits flexible across the course of the game. So I have not included it in a competitive deck, and I wouldn't going forward. I see why someone might, but it's not for me.
I still, you know, I have found a lot of times where having it in my hand has been a guaranteed extra point for Conquered Domain. Even playing Velmorn, I've had Jedrin shoved off an objective in the very last activation and in the last power step used it to score Hereditary Claims. And that is huge, in my opinion. That 2 points that I was otherwise not going to get out of an end phase. Hereditary Claims says, score this in an end phase if your warband holds 2 or more objectives and one or more of those objectives is not in your territory. That's 2 points I wouldn't have got otherwise. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I think that's where I like it, is you can better control the outcome of scoring at the end of a round with Tanglebriar than you can, because the stagger doesn't matter, right? Yeah, I mean, when the round ends, the stagger goes away, so whatever. But you're controlling a feature token in your hand, and I think that's what I like about it. There are gambits, if you go through, you know, if you're in round 2, round 3, round 1, sometimes you'll draw a gambit and you're like, doggone it, I don't know that I can use this, you know? I mean, that's a general experience with a lot of gambits. But I like this one because of the control it creates. Now, Mike made a good point in that, it, you know, sometimes it's just not available. And that I thought was an excellent point, because all of the planning comes to nothing if it's not available.
Yeah, so I guess my counterpoint to that is, you know, yes, you can control a feature token with your gambit. But I would say for me, I would prefer, you know, in our example of Jedrin being knocked off and now you don't get Hereditary Claims, you know, I like putting my fighters on guard. I'm going to give Siege Master as an upgrade. I'm going to put Stalwart Sentinel where I can't be pushed. I'm going to put Walking Wall on somebody and then they're always on a token. It doesn't matter where they go. Like, And then these eat up my upgrade slot, which is usually a little less valuable, a little less competitive. And so I personally have just found there are other ways to make sure that I'm on the token that I need that doesn't take away one of my gambits that I would rather use for increasing damage or accuracy or giving myself a push to move the places where I want to go. So, you know, differences of opinion. And it is just the way that, like I said, I like to play the counterpunch-ish thing. I'm not playing the full hold. Let me try and manipulate the tokens game that some fortressers will do. And apparently you guys play that style. But for me, I'm just not tanking Tanglebriar. I'm sorry.
It is not a good card. I love it, and it comes in clutch for me a lot, but I do think that depending on the matchup, or the pairing, I mean, your Warband is going to have better cards for that slot, certainly. I will argue quickly that each of the three cards you mentioned that you like better are, as you said, upgrades, which do cost glory. So depending on how early you are in the game and how winning you are in the game, Tanglebriar facilitating a quick bold sortie gets you points you needed to spend on upgrades. But I also, you know, we said it quickly before, but we do want to talk about, I called this a farewell to this card because, as you said, in Deathgorge, the box that is right around the corner now, there are no snare tokens, so this card will effectively do nothing. I've had a lot of fun with this card while it has worked. I do kind of hope maybe it gets an erratum or we see something that makes it playable. But as of now, it seems that this card will no longer function at all. And so I would like to say one final thank you to Tanglebriar, and I'm glad that I was able to get you guys on opposite sides of one. Do either of you have final comments for this Uncovered Secret segment?
Thank you, Tanglebriar. Thank you.
See ya.
All right. So with that, we will debut a new segment. We're going to call it Having a Good Time. Other Mike, do you want to walk us through this new segment?
Sure. So in Having a Good Time, hearkening back to my boy Gurzag Iron Skull, when he's having a good time, he's having a good time. And that's really why we play this game. We're not, you know, as we say at the opening, and we, as you should know by now, we're not the best competitive players that you've ever run across. But we do really enjoy the game, and we do have a lot of things to say about it. And one of the things that this game has is a set of characters, people who are on the field in the form of miniatures, or have flavor text on the cards. And these are individuals who are wandering the Weird Hollow, wandering the Death Gorge, wandering Shadespire, wherever they may be, doing whatever it is that they may be doing for whatever reasons they may have. And people don't really talk about that, but there is a lot of depth and character and lore to this game. And so we're going to totally go off the rails and just talk about stupid stuff and be goofs like we are. So in Having a Good Time, here's what we're going to do today. I'm going to present a scenario, and then we're all going to talk about who we think epitomizes this situation. So let's imagine that cryptocurrency exists in Warhammer Underworlds. Which Underworlds fighter do you think is most likely to have invested in cryptocurrency? Why did they do that? And did they make any money? Or how much did they lose? Who do you think they've convinced to join them? Let's talk. Who's the investor? Mike, what do you got for us?
Yeah, no, this was an easy one. It's almost like you set it up perfectly for me. It's Pac. Pac from Hexbane's Hunter is invested in cryptocurrency. He specifically invested in Dogecoin. The issue was he didn't make any money, and this left him deeply scarred. So that was the result of his investment. It was really unfortunate for him, really horrible.
The name of Having a Good Time should maybe be changed to Mike's Prepared Puns. Yeah, that's good. So if we got Pac, who invested in Dogecoin and is now deeply scarred.
And his deep shame is what keeps him from speaking ever again, I guess?
Yeah, no, I don't have much information about the fact that he doesn't talk and he's weirdly encapsulated in iron. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of information on that.
Yeah, very little of this segment is actually going to be based in the real lore of this game.
Yeah, it is a nice call out that he would invest in Doge,
though. Absolutely.
Okay, Thomas, who do you think is most likely to have invested in crypto and what's their story?
All right, so the first thing I thought of is who will have built up a scam coin, essentially. And so I definitely think that Grincrack the Great, I'm imagining that he has created a tether coin that he has tethered to the value of mushrooms. But he also manipulates the value of mushrooms. He owns that economy. So he has artificially inflated the value of this mushroom tether coin. He has sold it to all the other goblins. Everyone is bought into his hype, all of his loon court, of course, and it's even spread beyond them to any goblin that will listen. And then, of course, at the height of the inflated value of mushrooms and thus the inflated value of the mushroom tether coin, he sold out all of his share and then crashed the mushroom economy and made off like a bandit, with leaving a bunch of just stunned and a little bit stoned goblins in his wake.
Much.
That's the a crypto story as old as time.
The old story of the mushroom tether coin. Yeah, I've heard this before.
Grincrack's flavor text on his card says, Grincrack knows that he's probably sending his fighters to their deaths. He just doesn't much care. And I think that perfectly translates into he's more than happy to profit at the expense of his friends and family.
Oh, that's too much.
Yeah, that's the move. Okay, so we've got Pock investing in Doge. We've got Grincrack tying some mushrooms to a coin. I took a bit of a different tactic. So I looked at this and I said, okay, the crypto bro in general, like, who is this guy? So he's obviously into techno stuff, right? He's computery, electric sort of guy.
I'm tracking
so far. He hears about how they mine Bitcoin with these servers doing all these various computations. And like, what fighter would really care about that kind of thing? And then I realized Prentice Markov from The Exiled Dead fits this precisely. Because, I mean, first thing, right, he's got to love electricity, but he didn't come up with the idea on his own. He's been sold by some smooth operator. Dantalos, the Exile, says, you know, I've got these lightning rod zombies. Why don't you come play with me? And he probably at one point mentioned that he had some kind of electro coin, and Prentice Markov was all in, right? Like, he's obviously no stranger to a pyramid scheme. Like, look at his workplace, you know? so he's sitting there thinking, okay, you know, I get in at this level and then I get the next guy to go and it's all going to go up. And then when the right time comes, I go. And the other thing is one of the crypto bro hallmarks is that they're really into the idea of this unregulated marketplace, right? Like, the government can't tell me what to do. You know, the Fed isn't going to whatever. I have the ability to do all these things with peer-to-peer transactions and no bank gets involved. Like, that's the kind of thing that the crypto boy cares about, right? Well, if you are a Death War band who has been exiled for your weird ways and you say, yeah, the man isn't going to tell me what to do. I mean, that's it right there. So I'm pretty sure Dantalos sold him on it. And as a result, he's lost absolutely everything. Prentice Markov is in servitude to Dantalos for many different reasons. Financial is now one of them. But you know, there is this hope. There's a new coin. Maybe Regulus might spring for it.
Oh no.
I just got in on the ground floor, you know? So Prentice Markov, I think, is who it is. But there's obviously many other people who could have been investing in cryptocurrency. So we can open this up to the floor kind of for honorable mentions. If anyone has
Mike,
someone else.
Did you hear that? Markov got all of the zombies invested as well. Did you hear that? Did you hear about that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you tried.
Yeah, they're stoked on the whole blockchain. The blockchain is kind of
That one wasn't even a prepared pun. That one was just off there the cuff. Okay. Well, anybody have any honorable mentions they want to add?
I have one quick one. I think that Thundrick misunderstood what we meant by coins and absolutely thought these were real gold coins and is very upset about how his investment played out.
I mean, he does like Ether gold, and there's like an Ethereum coin, right?
Right, right.
So it's probably the one. But he likes technology, and he likes to promote himself. I mean, that's kind of a crypto thing.
Fair.
I've got a couple other honorable mentions. Mike, do you have anyone you want to add before I just go through my list?
No, man. I'm still trying to recover from Thomas's Grincrack mushroom tether.
Okay. So I think Vortimus is a good option because he thinks he's smarter than everybody else, and he can actually see the future occasionally. And so that's like the perfect, you know, gambler's fallacy situation. We've got my boy Draknar because he loves a bull market. And then we know Crookgrin literally carries money bags around. I mean, if you give the guy an opportunity for a coin, he's going to take it. So if you, listener, have any other ideas about who you think is the biggest crypto bro in Underworlds, give us a shout at underworldsunderground@gmail.com. Let us know where we're wrong and who actually is the one who's invested the most. And if they actually made any money, I'd be pretty impressed. But that's that's it for having a good time. And you can also hit us up if you have any ideas for how we can have a good time next time.
Absolutely.
You know, there's so many aspects of this game to talk about that don't have anything to do with the actual gameplay. And if you've got a funny thing we can talk about, let us know so we can bring it up next time.
All right. And with that, we'll move to the outro. Let's talk about where people can find us if they want to. We already mentioned the email address is underworldsunderground@gmail.com. Any questions or comments, anything you'd like us to address, we're happy to receive feedback of all shapes and sizes. Additionally, any ratings or reviews on any podcast service, we did finally make it onto Apple and Spotify and basically everything else at this point. You know, we appreciate any feedback in any way. And then feel free to reach out to us directly on any of the Discords. I am Saxthem. Mike is Sleekspole or Mike S sometimes. And other Mike is usually Fish Mode. And then anything else you guys would like to add there?
We are taking donations, but it must be sent to us in Dogecoin.
I'm particularly fond of Mushroom Tether, personally.
I'm not going to play the crypto game, so you can send your coins to them, and I can just watch as they burn.
And, of course, absolutely make sure that you check out the Sleekspole blog and the Spent Glory blog. Please send them to anyone you think that they may be useful for. And then with all of that in mind, this has been Underworlds Underground, coming to you straight from the root-lined halls of the Weird Hollow.